special session, lightning talks. I think we're going to do this again this year, so all the money. All right, so with that, we're going to transition to the next technical session, which is going to start. The title of the session is Crypto Without Errors, which is actually my favorite kind of crypto. and we're going to start with a talk by Dan Bernstein. He's going to tell us about four design choices. We're gonna keep the talk to 25 minutes or so. So we need 5 minutes for questions. So as Dan is speaking, please use your hard questions to ask him at the end of the talk. Dan, take it away.
All right, thank you. Can you walk the back? All right, thanks. So the basic message that I'd like to tell you in this talk is a message which has been stated many, many times. For instance, you heard it for a minute in the lightning talk session. I think one of the first statements of it, statement I particularly like, is from Ron Rivest in 1992. The context here is in 91, NIST proposed a digital signature standard, DSA, the Digital Signature Algorithm. And lots of people said, you know, if you think in 2015, yeah, NIST has built up a lot of cryptographic expertise, but in 1991, wait, who exactly came up with this digital signature algorithm? So the organization CPSR, Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, started filing Freedom of Information Act requests and eventually a lawsuit. And eventually NIST did it. Yeah, you're right, we didn't do it, NSA did it. So in 1992, NIST said, yeah, NSA came up with this digital signature algorithm. And this might start you thinking along the lines of, was this standard done maliciously? But that's not what this talk is about. That'll be the next one. Yes, we have a U.S. government representative who is told to download the wrong form to the story. 1994, NIST actually standardized this, but before that, they asked for comments, which, by law, they have to do, so that they can then throw them away. I mean, so that the public can express what they feel about the proposed standards. And Rivest had an amazing document where he goes through a lot of different aspects of DSA versus RSA. It's really interesting to look back at this. For instance, how he explicitly accuses NIST of imposing weak cryptography for the benefit of NSA and law enforcement agencies. And it makes lots of other interesting comments. Of course, a lot of things now you can say are obsolete. One thing that's definitely not obsolete, which I am going to focus on for this talk, is the following comment. He says, the poor user is given enough rope with which to hang himself, something a standard should not do. And he was in particular referring to exactly this repeated R problem that was already sort of mentioned in Elder Mall's original paper in 1985 on this type of signature scheme. And this has bitten people again and again and again. For instance, the PlayStation 3. The PlayStation 3, Sony for a while was selling PlayStations and said, yeah, these are computers. You can run Linux on these things. You can do homebrew meetings on these things. Everybody was happy. Maybe this had something to do with the fact that EU gave discounts for people who were selling computers. They didn't give tax breaks. They didn't give tax breaks to people who were selling game consoles. And then sometime around 2008-2009, the tax break expired and was not renewed. And suddenly Sony pushed an update which stopped people from booting Linux and running their homebrew games on PlayStation 3s. This pissed off the hacker community. And so within about a year, the PlayStation 3 security system was completely broken. Most importantly, the signature system that Sony used to sign all of the software that got loaded onto the PlayStation, their secret key was leaked through, you could say, their own stupidity. They took the nonce, a really well-generated random number for each DSA, each DSA signature, and they put it into their code to use again and again and again for every signature. They left out a line of code saying something like, just like in the XKCD, it would say something like some better day nonce equals, and then some random number with a comment saying, generated by a dice roll, really random. So they kept using this nonce again and again and again without even understanding what the word nonce meant. And as we told you, that's exactly the repeated R attack, Sony's secret key was just trivial calculation to figure out. And then, people noticed the repeated R's and broke the PlayStation security. Now, you could respond to this by exactly what you heard 15 minutes ago of blaming the implementer. In this case, blaming Sony. How could Sony be so stupid? The thing is that If you look at what Rivest said, he wasn't blaming Sony. He said the standard, the DSA standard, where exactly the same features were copied into the ECDSA, well, it's the same document from this perspective, Rivest was saying that what we should do is blame the standard, blame the algorithm, blame DSA. So instead of blaming the crypto implementer, we blame the crypto designer. Now, the reason it's important to blame the right person is that these give you different ideas of what you should do to React. If you say it's the implementer's fault, then you start thinking, well, how can the implementer work around this? How can the implementer make sure it's done correctly? How can the implementer generate the random number that DSA is asking for correctly and make sure it never repeats and doesn't have biases, etc.? With Rivest's response of blaming the designer, you have a bigger solution space because you're not just changing the implementations, you are changing the design. And so you can actually fix this in DSA. If you talk to NIST these days, they say DSA is sort of, well, okay, it's no longer completely non-compliant with FIPS 186-4 to do a deterministic version of DSA. That's not the same as saying, look, the algorithm has changed, you must do the following safe thing, which we can actually test that you're doing correctly. You can audit it and you can make sure that it works. You're still encouraged to do the bad thing, which creates all sorts of failure. So we will have this failure coming up again and again and again. All right, that was the short horror story which you've heard already. Let me give you another example of another type of implementation error, which I blame on the designer. So this type of error is not the code is generating bad random numbers, it is the code is taking variable time, where the variations leave your CPU. So the specific attack I'm highlighting here, this is from Oswick, Shamir, and Tromer in 2005, they were taking a Linux kernel where, okay, we know that that version of the Linux kernel, there's lots of ways to break into it, but they didn't break into it in that way. Of course, Linux now, it's all perfectly secure, you wouldn't have to worry about those problems. Okay, there's lots of ways to think about computer security, and of course we have to fix all of the different attack vectors. The attack vector that they were looking at was looking at the timing of the disk encryption in ADS software. So inside the DMCrypt disk encryption software, which is still what you use today, hopefully with some updates to stop this attack, there is ADS taking a secret key, which should never get out of the kernel, and taking some plain text that you're encrypting to store encrypted data on disk. Now, what they ran was a program which was not breaking into the kernel to steal its secrets, was not doing anything aside from looking at timings of not even timings directly on the ADS. They were just timing something that they were doing. And from seeing the timings of that, there was enough influence of the AES timings on the cache state that they were able to see the cache state through the timings of what they were running and figure out the AES. So the whole data flow here is that the AES implementation, AES software for most processors, the first thing you do is you take the first byte of the plain text, the first byte of the key, you XOR them together, you have a number between 0 and 255, and you look up that position in a table. And that takes a different amount of time depending on what the table position is and what your cache state is. It also influences the cache state. And that influence on the cache state, in turn, influenced the timings of this program that they were writing, and then with a lot of cleverness, they figure out what the AES key is. All right, total time for this attack was 65 milliseconds. Now, there's lots and lots of responses to this, lots of countermeasure papers, lots of attack papers. Of course, people say, oh, no, wait, we can change the software like this and implement AES in a secure way. And then, well, another paper comes along and says, no, that doesn't work because we can attack it like this. If you look at, for instance, this paper from 2012, it says, we posit that any data cache timing attack against x86 processors that does not somehow subvert the prefetcher, physical indexing, and massive memory requirements of modern programs is doomed to fail. Plus other things like multi-core, etc. Now, as an implementer, okay, if you're serious about doing implementations, you know all about virtual indexing, physical tagging, prefetching strategies, you know about these for performance reasons, and you can also think about them from a security perspective, and well, you can try to get this right, and then you still end up getting broken. For instance, here's a 2014 paper, which recovers the AES keys from OpenSSL 1.0.1, running under VMware inside of VM. They took a totally separate VM. So now, if it, to do a traditional kind of non-cryptographic attack, you would have to break through the hypervisor to get to the other VM. But this cryptographic attack is finding the AES keys in 60 seconds through cache timing. Okay, after a whole lot of these papers, the bottom line is we still don't have secure AES. You can say, well, wait a minute, AES, of course AES is secure, lots of people have tried and failed to break it, but the actual usage of AES is not secure. And you can think about that in different ways, and I'll try to say how I want to think about this. Bottom line again is that we do not have a secure system. And the insecurity here is coming from, well, all sorts of implementations of AES. One side comment I have here is that the goal of the academics, namely to contribute to human knowledge, to publish more papers, this is being well served by having a system that's on the edge of breakability, because then you get to write a paper saying, yes, we broke it, and then you write another paper saying, no, here's a countermeasure, and then as long as these things are just on the edge of human knowledge, they're interesting, they produce more papers, they don't give you a secure system, but they make academics happy. So there's a conflict of goals between what the users want and what the academics want. Okay. The underlying problem here, I would agree to AES, that the AES design is something where if you try to implement it in the simple way, you do exactly what I said with variable indexing into memory, and that creates a security problem. If you try to do AES in a fast way, you, on most processors, end up with the security problem. If you do a secure implementation, on some processors you can do that efficiently. But on most processors, if you do a secure implementation of AES, it is complicated and it's slow. Maybe there's a performance problem that you don't really care about, so if you're worried that your software, you want your software to be widely used, or you actually have yourself a serious speed problem, then you're not happy with the software, which is, well, running slower than it could be. And even if you don't care about performance, it's just annoying to write this software. It takes a lot of work to write constant time AES software. So all of these papers saying, yeah, here's what the implementers should do this right, they end up, well, they're blaming the implementer, they're saying we should look for a solution in the implementation space, and that ends up being very complicated, and annoying, and expensive, and hard to review. What you can do instead is not just insist on using this design, the AES design, and then vary the implementations, but you can actually allow the design to vary. And then you find that it's much, much easier to get a secure system, because there's now lots and lots of ciphers which completely avoid this problem. There's lots and lots of ciphers where the simplest implementations are secure implementations, and they're competitive in speed with AES, sometimes even faster than AES, sometimes even faster than AES hardware. So it's really not necessary to have all of these problems. And as a designer, if you're saying, well, what am I going to do to build a cipher? If you just think I want some abstract mathematical notion of security where I'm looking at what the outputs of the cipher are, and then I don't care about timing, you will end up with something that maybe looks a lot like AES, and it suddenly becomes very hard to implement. If you think about the implementation, then you end up with something which is much easier to implement and still satisfies all the other constraints that you want. Okay, what's happening here in general is that there's a cryptographic design, well, lots of different cryptographic designs, and then these turn into implementations. And the implementations, that's a more complicated part of the system than the designs, because the implementations have to worry about different platforms, optimizing for things. The designer just says, I've got some abstract machine model, I know, yeah, this runs fast, and I'll just do this fast thing. The implementer actually has to worry about how fast it is. And then from a security perspective, the implementer is thinking, what about timing? What about other side channels? What about, well, okay, I'm trying to optimize something for a particular platform using some instruction. Does that instruction always do what I expect it to do? There ends up being, because of the extra complications of implementations, there ends up being a lot more stuff that somebody has to look at to figure out whether the system is secure, including security questions that the designer traditionally doesn't even ask, like timing. Okay, bottom line, the implementations end up being less secure than the designs for the different notions of security that these two types of people use. The big picture is actually more than this, because everything that I've been saying about design versus implementation is also reflected in design versus protocol design. So you have not just AES and an implementation of AES, but it's AES and then something built on top of AES. And then more protocols built on top of that. And there's these huge layers of protocols. People talk about higher and higher level protocols from a security perspective, of course, it's lower and lower level. And so security is going that way, low security is going this way. From the attacker's perspective, down here is great. If you want the lowest security you can, take the most complicated protocol you can and then implement it. This is going to be a complete security disaster down here at the protocol implementations level. Welcome to the abyss. This is not a happy picture. Concrete example of this. Suppose you're doing elliptic curves. You're saying, I want to use elliptic curves for some application. Then, well, there's going to be a protocol designer who has to decide, okay, what's actually sent through the network, where he maybe doesn't know all the details of the application, but if you want to actually specify a protocol in a formal sense, and the sense that you actually implement, you have to say what goes through the network. You can't just abstract away that detail. So where some designer just thinking about the math might think, oh, an elliptic curve point, you send that through the network somehow. At some point, somebody, the protocol designer, has to say, I'm going to send an X and a Y through the network. But does that always work? Well, no, not all of your elliptic curve points can be XY. Actually, do I want to send XY? Or do I want to send something more compressed, like just an X and one bit of Y, for instance? And if the designer starts thinking, what is the implementer going to do? Then the designer realizes at some point that, hey, the implementations that use compressed points, it's not just that it's saving bandwidth, but those are actually going to be much more robust. The designer really should be asking for these things, what am I going to get out of the system? What sort of review is going to happen? Is the implementer going to screw things up? I'll ask this list of questions on another slide. For this slide, I'm going to emphasize the review. If you've got a mathematician coming into cryptography and saying, okay, I'm going to study some part of cryptography, what do I know about? Maybe it's discrete logarithms. And so you get dozens and dozens and dozens of people who study discrete logarithms, say elliptic curve discrete logarithms. How many of them have actually looked at the security of ECDSA, which is a protocol using discrete logs? Or if you think of ECDSA as the primitive, then how many people have gone beyond ECDSA and looked at implementations of ECDSA? Or going from the primitive to a protocol, how many people have looked at ECDSA as used in certificate validation and certificate generation, whatever other ECDSA applications you have not. There's, of course, much more review of the simpler things, because if you're writing papers, and you have some graduate student writing papers, you focus on some simple problem where you can write a comprehensible paper about it. It's much harder to write a paper about some complicated problem, even though those complicated problems are the hardest ones to get fixed, and things where we really need to focus and get these things fixed. I should comment that there's another approach to dealing with these problems, saying, well, we've got the design, and we've got the implementation, we've got the protocols. There's an approach called provable security. This is supposed to be an approach to security, which says we're going to have proofs as a substitute for review. Instead of having lots of people think about discrete logs and then trying to tell them, hey, you should also think about ECDSA and see if there's security problems there and think about what's going through the network and think about the application, we should tell people, okay, we don't have to think about it. So the strategy of provable security is to say that we're going to prove that the protocol is as secure as the primitive. And we're going to prove that the implementation of the protocol is as secure as the protocol. And once you have that proof, then somebody who's reviewing your system doesn't have to look at the protocol anymore. Somebody doesn't have to look at the implementation because you've proven that those things are secure. So the security reviewer just has to look at the design of the primitive, not the implementation of the primitive, not the protocols. The reviewer can just focus on, say, the discrete log problem, or focus on AES. So that's the theory about provable security. But, well, obviously, this hasn't worked yet. Even if it's going to work, you can be an optimist and say, yeah, maybe at some point this will work. But obviously it hasn't, because if it had, we would have secure crypto, and we don't. Let me go through a few of the problems that this approach has been facing, the easiest one being errors in proofs. I think once I'm done with crypto, once I feel like crypto is working, doing fine, then maybe next thing I do is computer security in general. And once that's all solved, I think what I'd actually like to do is work on people doing proofs and not getting them right because it's not computer assisted. I think it's a really interesting topic. I've actually been spending more and more time looking at these automation aspects of proofs. And I think it's something where we can make progress. But right now, there's lots and lots of errors in proofs. Right now, a typical proof of a typical protocol, never mind a typical implementation, a typical proof is going to be completely unreadable, not computerized, not reviewed, and it will more often than not have mistakes. That, I said, was the easy problem. This is one where I do think there will be a solution eventually. Number two, it's not so obvious as a solution, which is loose proofs, proofs that aren't tight. So people say, we're proving the system is secure. But what they actually mean is, we're proving that the system is secure against an attacker who can only carry out 20 computations. Excuse me, can't the attacker do 2 to the 64 computations? Yes, yes, but that's not what this proof is about. So there's a quantitative gap. The proof is saying, yes, here's a system that's secure. For instance, the Schnorr signature system. There's a forking model proof that the system is secure. But if you actually look at what the proof means for any typical size of Schnorr signatures, then you realize the proof is not saying anything useful because it's quantitatively not strong enough. It doesn't guarantee that the protocol is as secure as the primitive. It just guarantees that the protocol is, well, there's some quantitative relationship, but it's too weak to actually tell you anything. It's not at all clear that this problem can be fixed. Sometimes, well, let's be optimistic and imagine that we can find protocols where we do have tight security proofs. Then there's problem number three, which is that the notion of security keeps changing. You can find papers where people think about security taking, for instance, timing into account, but most of the time people don't. So for instance, let's take a simple example. Authenticate, then encrypt. Mac, then encrypt. So you MAC your message, you had it, depending on your encryption, then it's encrypted. Is this secure? Now, there's quite a few papers which clearly say that the answer is yes, under reasonable assumptions about the authentication and the encryption. Assumptions that we do believe are achievable and achieved by realistic authentication and encryption mechanisms. However, when this gets implemented, say in HTTPS, then it turns into a complete disaster. Because, for example, lots of information is leaked through timing. When somebody decrypts, they decrypt, and then they have to check for the padding and the timing of checking the padding and the MAC. This is something which depends on secret data in a way that leaks information to an attacker. And this has been exploited again and again and again and again. At which point, the people who have the security definition saying, wait, timing, that doesn't mean anything in our security definitions. Those people say, you have some implementation problem. You have to deal with that. It can constantly go off and you have to bring some constant time software, which can be done, but it's not the right way to make the system secure. It has been a failure so far, and this is not the approach we want to take. It's one of the reasons that we should be using encryption than MAC. Okay, so security definitions vary, and the people who are designing things are not designing for the same security notions that the attacker cares about and the user cares about. But okay, let's be optimistic and think we can get past this, that we get the right security definitions, we take account of all of the different side channels, all of the implementation-related issues that are separating implementation security from design security, and similarly, all of the protocol security issues, get these right, multi-user security, etc. And then we get to problem number four. Everything I've said so far is saying, well, it's hard to reach the fundamental goal. This fourth problem is actually something that really bothers me about the fundamental goal, because it says that the fundamental goal might be a bad idea. It might be contrary to security. There's more and more evidence of this, that the main way that we are actually going to achieve fixing all these problems and getting to the fundamental goal of provable security is by switching to weak primitives, which does achieve the goal. If your primitive is weak enough, then your whole system is at least as secure as your primitive. And there's more and more examples, which I decided not to spend my talk on, of people actually moving in this direction to achieve provable security by adding more and more structure to their primitives in order to allow security proof, which also makes the primitives weaker. And that bothers me, because that means that this whole provable security idea, even if the fundamental goal is achieved, it doesn't mean we're achieving security. Okay, so back to what I think should be done. The crypto designers, if you're designing something or evaluating a design, then think of the children. Think of the people who are actually going to have to suffer through implementing this design, and what are they actually going to end up doing? And it's usually not a pretty picture, but if you think about it, then and you think, how can I solve this? Then you actually end up with designs which are a lot easier to implement securely. Sometimes you can make them so easy to implement securely and so hard to implement insecurely that you don't even have to worry about what the implementer does. This really is achievable by the designer. At least it's something that you should be thinking about. If you're doing a design of something lower level, then just like you should be thinking about the implementer, you should be thinking about the poor protocol designer who has to use your primitive. Coming back to the elliptic curve case again, if you think, okay, the protocol designer is maybe going to be protecting the implementer by sending compressed points through the network, that's something where if you look at how elliptic curve attacks work, then sending compressed points really reduces the flexibility of the attacker. And something which really simplifies making a secure implementation. But does it completely simplify it, or does it just reduce the damage? Well, if you're designing a curve, then you can choose a curve so that when people send compressed points, it really does completely protect the implementation. And this is something where next generation, non-NIST or maybe future NIST, from what we heard, curves are actually going through this whole chain of protecting the implementations of the protocols, because everybody agrees that curves should be what's called twist secure. And this is something which is thinking through multiple levels of how the system is built and designing the curves so that the protocol designer can protect the implementer. And that's an example where something's actually working. But there's 1,000 of these little decisions to make, and it really takes effort to get all of these right. I have a few minutes left, and I thought I would, in those few minutes, tell a short third harvest story. In case I was completely out of time, I would, here's the abbreviated version of the horror story. There's going to be a talk later, I think, about let'sencrypt.org, which is clearly going to be successful. It is easy to use, and that is the thing that, beyond everything else, has stopped HTTPS from being very widely deployed. I'm confident that let'sencrypt.org is going to be widely deployed, and I have the luxury of having heard it talk about it before, but for anybody who hasn't heard it, you should come to that talk. However, saying HTTPS is going to be successfully widely deployed is not the same as saying that we're going to have security. You might say, well, look, I tried TCP dump, and HTTPS was clearly much less data linkage to TCP dump or Wireshark than not having HTTPS. Got much less data, which is, you know, better than having no encryption at all. It must be good to have encryption. Except most of the attacks that we're seeing against HTTPS, most of the vulnerabilities, are things that active attackers can easily carry out. And the fact that you can't see something carrying out a lazy passive attack doesn't say you have a secure system. You might also say, well, if somebody's carrying out active attacks, they will know we're under attack because somebody will detect it. It's not as silent as passive eavesdropping. But I've got news for you. We are under attack. You're not learning anything by forcing people to reveal that you're under attack. We are all under attack. So this also doesn't strike me as a substitute for actually securing the system. I think I'll skip quickly through details of this horror story that I wanted to tell, which is about Reichenbacher. Let me just recommend to you some slides from Matt Green from the Crypto for 2020 workshop in 2013, where he goes through things that are bothering you about TLS. For instance, on the design level, he says that proving the security of TLS 1.2's defense against the Reichenbacher attack, this is something which requires a goofy made-up assumption. But then he gets to implementations. Here we go, blaming the implementer again. The problem with TLS is that it recurs with implementations. And he observes that in OpenSSL, OpenSSL is doing the old defense against Reichenbacher, not the new TLS 1.2 defense, and that's clearly the wrong thing to do. You'll never be able to prove that it's secure. It's probably not secure if you're doing a serious enough timing attack. And this sort of thing, not against OpenSSL, but this sort of thing was successfully exploited in August 2014, a paper which is actually breaking some SSL implementations using a timing oracle inside Reichenbacher's attack. So, okay, there's some references for you to follow if you're interested in that. the lesson that I draw from this is that the designers focusing on something like RSA encryption, that is not actually the primitive that we want to give to implementers. So if you're doing RSA, you're in serious trouble against this type of attack, and instead of saying, hey, let's have the implementer do a lot of work to get this right, let's fix the crypto design, where if you think carefully about what public key encryption is supposed to do, you quickly end up going through a sequence of transformations that ends up with throwing away RSA and putting in elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman instead. And that sort of fix completely eliminates the implementation. All right, my last slide is some exercises for you. Traditionally, people will look at, this is not a complete list, but I tried to do some highlights of HTTPS failures in chronological order. Traditionally, people look at these and say, if the implementer could have fixed this problem, then we blame the implementer. I would like to push back on that and say, if the designer could have fixed this problem, then we should blame the designer. So if you're a designer, ask not what your implementer can do for you. Ask what you can do for your implementer. Thank you for your time.
We have 2 minutes for 2 questions.
Yes.
Hey there.
Alex.
So I've heard Marius on your thoughts on provable security in a number of talks. They always hint that provable security is something that you would like to see go away. Is that true?
I didn't say at any moment that I think provable security should go away.
And
I didn't
say that you said that.
I'm just expressing concerns about first, second, and third, the difficulty of achieving the fundamental goal. I think what I'm stating as the fundamental goal is not controversial as this is the goal of provable security. And problems 1, 2, 3, I think, are well-recognized problems of achieving this goal. Problem 4 is, I think, a serious, I would dare say, fundamental question about whether that fundamental goal is actually what we want. Because the obvious way to achieve the fundamental goal is to make the primitive weak. And the primitives are, in provable security literature, getting weaker and weaker. Now, you can try to fight against that in various ways, like we insist that the primitive be elliptic curve discrete logarithms on the following curve. And then you are directly tackling problem 4. But it's not a problem you can just ignore, because, I mean, if you think about it logically, or you look at what provable security is actually doing, and this really says the fundamental goal is not necessarily tied, in fact, there's strong reasons to believe it's against the goal of achieving security. I'm not saying that provable security is a bad idea. I'm saying that it's something where you need some skepticism.
So, as a counterpoint, I think your interpretation of the fundamental goal is wrong.
I'm sure this will be a good lunchtime discussion.
Yeah, that's a good time. Let's take one more question. Yeah?
So, TLS is bad. What is MLT coming up?
So there's a few proposals for doing something better than TLS. Actually, what I found most striking was Hugo Kopchick's proposal for OPTLS, which was rejected by the TLS working group on grounds of, what, that's so different, how could that be better, basically. And what he's doing, like what Minimalt is doing, what Google's Quick is doing, is, and Axelotl and so on, is basically very simple Diffie-Hellman, and then after that, there's some little decisions you can make of exactly what the forward secrecy properties will be and what the efficiency properties will be, and you try to integrate with DNS. But I mean, there's basically a totally clear thing to do to throw away all of the garbage that we call HTTPS key exchange and replace it by something much simpler, much more obviously secure, much easier to implement. And that's what all of these replacements are aiming for. So again, take a look at Minimal, you ask when it's coming out, and I believe the Linux release will happen this year. I'm not in charge of it. Tommy and I are just a cryptographic device team for the protocol, and other people are doing the actual software. But the Linux board will happen.
Great, thanks, Dan.